Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Vietnam War ended more than four decades ago, but its memory lingers, especially in the minds of those who served. The war itself was unusual at the time, a war without a clear front and often without clear objectives. Historian Jim Wright's latest book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War, looks at the Vietnam War through the eyes of those who served. He draws on many interviews with veterans who were there. And let's hear from you about this war. What do you want to know about it? Were you there? Did you serve? And if you did, what did things look like on the ground? Did you and those who served with you question the meaning of the war? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Jim Wright joins me now in the studio. He's also President Emeritus and Eliezer Wheelock Professor of History Emeritus at Dartmouth College. Jim Wright, welcome to the program.
Peter, I'm delighted to be here with you.
Delighted to have you, of course. And so tell us, why did you decide to do this book?
I've been concerned for a number of years about veterans. I've been working with veterans mainly of our current wars. I've been visiting them in the hospital since 2005 and have tried to provide counseling for them, but this led to a broader interest in veterans and a concern about the way that we have increasingly abstracted war. We think of war as something that's carried on by drones or shock and awe campaigns, and most troubling of all, we talk about sending in troops as putting boots on the ground. And I want to always point out to people that we're not talking about shoe leather that goes to war. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about flesh and blood. And I just want to tell the story about a generation that I think has not been properly remembered. We've talked about their war. We debated their war. I'm not trying to make a strong persuasive case, I can assure you, for the rightness of the Vietnam War, but I'm talking about a generation of Americans that served, far more of them than we have credited for. We went to the play Hamilton last year in New York, and there's a wonderful line in there, Eliza Hamilton talking about remembering, and she said, who lives, who dies, who tells the story? And in its essence, that's what war is about. We may abstract it a lot. We may pretend that it's not about that, but it's purpose, its cruel purpose, is who lives and who dies, and then we have to think about who tells the story.
Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to hear in this hour many personal stories from veterans out there. If you are interested in sharing your story, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This book, of course, is a history book, but based on the personal stories, that was a deliberate effort on your part to incorporate the personal stories of veterans who served. Tell us why you think that personal story is important.
Well, because I think war is, stripped of everything else, is a very human endeavor. It's a remarkable test of moral codes and courage and ability to work with other people and independence. I'm surely not trying to romanticize war. I'm not trying to make it dramatic. But it's a very human endeavor, and it tests us at our core. And I don't think you can tell the story of war without talking about the experience of those who were there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the war itself and how it became what it became in popular culture, especially in the late 1960s. But that's not when it started. It started earlier than that. Tell us about the beginning of American involvement and political interests in Vietnam.
Well, the combat involvement, the ground involvement began in March of 1965 when President Johnson sent some Marines into Da Nang. Then he sent some Army units in rather quickly, and there was a pretty rapid escalation of troop buildup there. In many ways, it had begun after the French had pulled out with the Geneva Accords following Dien Bien Phu, when the French army was defeated in the north. And we had a great interest there. It became part of a global contest with communism, Southeast Asia. And it was where we increasingly put a lot of our focus. Many people had warned us not to go there for a land war. Johnson understood the complexity of going there for a land war. He was not looking necessarily for a military victory, even though he talked about bring the old coonskin back and we'll hang it on the wall and all of that. I think that they're using the military to press the North Vietnamese into some sort of negotiation. And we find the military used this way increasingly since World War II, and it's not necessarily a good way to use military force. And it's certainly, we have to remember again that we're sending young kids in to try to encourage some sort of political negotiation.
Mm-hmm. One of the ideas at the time was what's known as the domino theory, right, which is that if Vietnam became a communist nation, other nations would follow and fall like a domino into the hands of the communists.
And indeed, it was common rhetoric at the time, if we don't fight them here, we'll have to fight them in the streets of Los Angeles. There really was a sense where Vietnam, in many ways, the war was not about Vietnam, although obviously it was part of the rhetoric, part of the understanding, part of the rationale. But it was really about a global contest with communism, which in the earlier 50s had been more focused on the Soviet Union. By the mid and later 50s, communist China was very much a part of this, and it was part of this global contest, and we thought Vietnam was the place where we'd have to draw the line.
At that point in 1965, how supportive was the American public of the war?
I think they were very supportive early on. There were protests from the beginning. People who did not like the rationale for the war didn't understand what we were doing there. But by and large, I think that the public image of the first troops that were sent into Vietnam was of heroic freedom fighters trying to defend democracy in the jungles of Vietnam, even though most people may not have been able to find Vietnam on the map. Johnson thought it could be done crisply. He didn't think it would take that long. I don't think that anyone calculated the length of the war, the number of casualties there. But one has to think about those things. One has to think about, I think yesterday on this program, Dante Scala talking about war powers, that we have to think about the unintended consequences of war, and the Vietnam War had rolling unintended consequences. It's not that anyone set out deliberately to construct the Vietnam War as it evolved.
Though, as some historians have written, and as you cite in this book, there were many points along the way through Johnson and then the Nixon administration where escalation in the conflict was a choice. They could have chosen to withdraw, but did not.
They did. They did not choose to withdraw. They really thought that escalation was a necessary raising of the stakes to make certain that we could protect the government of the South. If the South Vietnamese government fell, it clearly would have taken away most rationale for the war, and also to press North Vietnam to negotiate. And so, but the escalation was always pretty calculated. Johnson really raised the stakes pretty quickly, but then after Tet, he started to draw back some.
We've got a question coming in about the draft. Let's talk with Peggy in Center Harbor. Peggy, what's your question or comment?
It's not a question, it's a comment. I just wanted to note that when you're talking about the Vietnam War, you're talking about the majority of soldiers being there involuntarily. They were drafted. They had no choice. They had to go, unless they were college students, in the first few years of the war. I know that changed later on, but If you were a college student, you weren't drafted. So if you didn't have the financial means or the opportunity to go to college, and you were a male, you were pretty much sure of going to Vietnam, whether you wanted to or not.
So let's pick up that comment from Peggy, Jim Wright, in the draft. What percentage do you think over the course of the war were these gentlemen fighting on the ground draftees, and which percentage decided to join?
The number of draftees certainly increased. Peggy is quite correct. I think early in the war there were more volunteers, and indeed throughout the war there were more volunteers in the military than there were draftees. But there was a force at work there that where the draft would cause some people to volunteer to enlist, because they got to choose the time they went in. They could choose a branch of service they went into. They had more flexibility in that regard. And it's hard to sort out how many volunteered that did it only because of the draft. By 1967 or so, increasingly the casualties were draftees. They weren't early on. By 1967, the baby boomers, those born after 1946, became the dominant numbers in the casualties, and that number increased after that. But a lot of people signed up. I interviewed a number of people and asked them, and they signed up. Remember, early on, again, we can't look back at it from the late 60s perspective, but early on, fighting for democracy, these were the sons of the World War II generation. These were kids that had been brought up with duck and cover drills in the schools. These were kids that were brought up and reminded regularly of the international threat of communism. These were kids that had been brought up and told that they had a responsibility to serve when they were asked to serve. And they did join, and they were eager to defend freedom. I think very quickly in Vietnam, their idea of that war changed pretty dramatically, but I don't think we should minimize those who volunteered. 40% of the baby boom generation served in the military. More of them died in Vietnam than went to Canada or went to prison for fighting against the draft. And we just have to recognize that this generation did fight. They came to have very mixed to negative feelings about the war, to be sure, but they did fight.
Let's talk to Jerry in Dover. Jerry, what's your question or comment?
Hi. I'm a Vietnam vet, and when I went to Vietnam, I was very, very gung-ho. And I sincerely believe that we were over there fighting for the ability to allow the Vietnamese to have free elections and to have a democracy. And I was there about a month or two. And I believe it was President Tu threw all of his the candidates that were running against him in jail, and he wound up running by himself. So here I am looking at this, and I'm thinking, wow, I guess I'm not fighting for the right to guarantee the Vietnamese the right to a free election. So I, like many of the vets that served on the ground, like me, that wound up fighting for the guy that was on our right or our left or our wingman. And they were the people that many of the Vietnam vets fought for, not for the Vietnamese.
Jerry, thank you very much for your comment. Really appreciate that. So, yeah, let's talk about the sort of perception of the purpose of the war from the perspective of those who were there. Jerry said that he started off very supportive of the effort, but quickly became disillusioned when he arrived in Vietnam. Was that a common thing that you heard as you conducted your interviews?
I think it was fairly common, and some people became disillusioned very quickly. Some people talked about coming to the airport and being on a bus and realize that their bus had screening around it, and sometimes people were throwing mud at the buses, and I think that people had the experience Jerry did of recognizing that the government was fairly cynical, that it was not as democratic as they had been told. They came to realize that most of the civilian Vietnamese population really did not want them there. Just wanted to mind their farms, just wanted to do their business, didn't want the the foreign troops there didn't want a war out in their ice paddies, and they came to realize that that the war itself lacks sometimes a clear sense of direction. And as he said, I think this is actually probably true of most wars. Men in combat, men in battle, are fighting for themselves, they're fighting for their lives, they're fighting for their buddies. They're looking right and left and looking after each other. They're certainly trying to accomplish the goal that they have that day or in that firefight or that activity. But their fundamental thing is to look out for each other. And I think that this sense of buddies is a terribly important thing. It's far deeper than friendship.
Mm-hmm. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and I'm speaking with Jim Wright. He is the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam. Did you endure Vietnam? And does Vietnam still endure for you, in your mind? What's your experience? Tell us now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your thoughts on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. You spent, quite a bit of time here focusing on the spring of 1969. Why was that such a key time?
I think the spring of 1969 was a major transition period in the war, Peter. It was a time, remember, Nixon had been elected in 1968 in November. He'd assumed office, inaugurated in January. He talked about a secret plan to end the war. It was not clear that there was ever any secret plan there, but he also recognized that the signal was it was time to begin to draw down. And in May of 1969, he announced that he no longer, that we were not going to seek a military victory. We never really had, but he made it explicit for the first time. In June, he talked about Vietnamization. He announced that we're going to begin drawing down American troops and turning over more of the war to ARVN, to the South Vietnamese Army. We had the Battle of Hamburger Hill, which I do focus on here, which became a very a difficult battle in May of 1969, but also became politically symbolic. And Nixon sent the word out that he didn't want these sorts of fights engaged in again. It was a change in the nature of the war, and you can begin to see that at that time.
Yeah, public perception certainly was changing around that time, and one of the things that influenced it was this fascinating spread of photos in Life magazine in June of 1969 that shared, 217 photos of soldiers, Marines, and other military personnel who were killed in Vietnam. In your view, what impact did that visual of the human cost of war have on the American public?
Yeah, I remember the magazine when it came out, June 27th magazine of 1969. And when I wrote my previous book, I wanted to turn to that, and I got a copy of it from eBay. And it's still a very powerful-looking magazine. It's 20-some pages of pictures, and they're high school graduation photos, their boot camp or basic training graduation photos. They just gives their age and their hometown. They're 19, 20 years old, and they look even younger than that. I think it did have an impact. I'm not sure how we can, I don't think there's ever been a measurement of how much it changed, but clearly by then there was a recognition that we need to begin to draw down the war. And later in 1969, when the news of My Lai came out, I think that had some major consequences on the perceptions of the troops there. By 67, we thought of them as poor kids who were being dragged off to send a cruel and unjust war. After My Lai, we started thinking of them as the perpetrators of a cruel and unjust war. I think that the number of people who accused them of that was small, but they're very vocal. Lyndon Johnson, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? In 67, by 69, 70, the kids coming home were called baby killers.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the My Lai massacre that you referenced. We'll talk about protests and what effect, if any, they had on the decision to end the conflict in Vietnam. We're talking with Jim Wright, the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam. If you served or if you have questions about the Vietnam War, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR's Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we are talking with Jim Wright today. He is the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War. And we want you to be a part of this discussion. What do you want to know about this war? Did you or a family member serve in Vietnam? What was it like? Did you discuss the war with your fellow soldiers or Marines or airmen or sailors? What were those discussions in the jungles like? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk a little more about what it was like on the ground in Vietnam. We've got some interviews to discuss with Jim Wright here, but we also want to get to your calls. And we've got Rudy from Agawam, Massachusetts on the line. Rudy, what is your question or comment?
Well, hi, I'm glad that you're writing this book. I'm a Vietnam vet. I was there 69-70 with my first CO was George Patton Jr. But anyway, it's been, as I said, it's the screener. It's been a generational thing for all of us who were there that we've fought this war. We tried to figure out, I think, what happened to us. I've always thought that when we were going over there, average age was probably around 18, 19, the time when we're sort of going from adolescence into adulthood, yet we're in country learning how to kill. You know, at times other people are in college and that kind of thing. So. And the other thing is, too, I've participated in teaching a class at the Groton School, Groton Mass, to the kids there on the Vietnam War. And it's really a rewarding thing because many kids don't know what Vietnam was. And it was helpful to us, therapeutic, because it was another guy who was in the Army. But anyways, my compliments on the book. I hope that people can read this and understand what it was like. I think the main goal is to never have something like that happen again, although there was Iraq that sort of brought up a lot of those feelings about going to war that we went through. So that's my comment. I don't know if you have any questions or whatever. So,
well, Rudy, I was curious because you called. Stick with us a moment. How do you go about processing your memories of Vietnam these days?
Well, you know, part of it is the PTSD. I mean, you know, I'm retired now, but there were times when I was working where I would have little vignettes. I would see something. In fact, you know, driving up to New Hampshire, I would see something on the side of the road that might have reminded me of a blown-out area that we would use as what they call an NDP, a night defensive position. And it'd be like a little movie reel, maybe 3 or 4 seconds, but you'd sort of, and you'd be driving. And, you know, it's like that. You know, I hate to be political, but, you know, the president avoided the draft 5 times, and yet I have to go into a VA now. I go to the hospital and look at this guy, and it's kind of like putting, you know, salt into a wound. But that's just my thoughts.
Well, Rudy,
anyway,
thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, the VAs generally hang portraits of the president on the wall. That's what his reference is to seeing the president at VA hospitals. But Jim Wright, in the course of researching this book, you learned a lot about the experience of Vietnam veterans coming home with memories of this war. In fact, you write that, you know, some veterans had nightmares and some had daymares. Like they could not get some of these haunting images out of their mind.
I think that's true, and I, you know, in many ways I think it's true of combat veterans of any war. It was not something we had this thing in the 1970s where we called this the Vietnam syndrome to make it sort of singular and to make it like this was a generation that was uniquely unable to process their experience, so that they couldn't stand up like real men and move beyond it. And they were told this by some of the World War II veterans, get over it. We did. They didn't. And I think that it's important for people like Rudy and others to talk about this. In the 1970s, it was not an environment where they could talk about it. The number of people that I spoke to that said I came home and nobody ever asked me about Vietnam. I'm not sure that they wanted to talk about it, but they expected to be asked. Somebody said you would have, you know, I could have had the same suntan coming back from Florida, and they would have said, "Did you have a good trip?" And it was very hard on them. And I got a note last week from an email that somebody had read the book. He was a combat veteran in Vietnam, and said, "Thank you for telling the stories that we combat veterans can't tell ourselves." And my response to him and Rudy and others is, yes, you do have to tell the stories yourselves. It's not easy, but I think it's part of the process of sharing. And it's not just therapeutic for them to tell the stories. The rest of us have to hear these stories. We have to recognize that this is what war is. This is what we ask young people to do. And they stand up and they do it on our behalf, and we need to applaud them for that. But thank you for your service is not adequate. We need to do better.
You mentioned before the break, My Lai, the massacre that was sort of a turning point in public perception of the war, and which may have also led to a lot of negative perception of veterans who served, even if they had nothing to do with My Lai. But for listeners who aren't aware, tell us about what My Lai was.
My Lai was a massacre at a village at Pinkville that the military called My Lai on the maps. We went in there, an AmeriCal unit went in there. They thought there were Viet Cong there. They said there were Viet Cong there. And they went in and they ended up slaughtering about 600 civilians who were by no stretch of the imagination enemy. These were women and children. They were put together in groups and they were killed. It was a terrible, horrible massacre. William Calley led the army platoon in there. He participated in the killing himself. He was court-martialed for it. Nixon put him on house arrest rather than put him in prison because there was a great outcry. You can't punish somebody for fighting a war. And I think one of the great tragedies of Vietnam is what happened at My Lai. There are many tragedies there. The tragedy is compounded, I think, when more Americans in the 1970s would have known William Calley as somebody who fought in Vietnam rather than knowing the hundreds of thousands of other kids who fought there without participating in these sorts of horrible activities.
Mm-hmm. And there is some debate, too, about whether or not events like My Lai were commonplace or whether this was sort of an outlier. In your research, which of those two do you think is more true?
I think in terms of its scale, in terms of the horror of it, it was clearly an outlier. There were, I do discuss in the book, some other instances. There were clearly some horrible things that happened there. But the idea that everybody did it, I reject quite emphatically. They did not do it. These kids that went over there were not all psychotics trying to kill everyone that they saw.
Let's go back to the calls and let's talk to Sharon in Exeter. Sharon, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I am a baby boomer. I'm 70 now. And so I was in the period where the Vietnam War had started and it had grew and it changed my life dramatically. I wasn't involved in the war in any way except for a boyfriend of my sister's went over and he came home, and so it wasn't like that. But I was raised by Republicans. My father fought in World War II in England. My mother was English. They married and came home to America to start a new life. They were loyal Republicans, and I was a Republican too. I voted for Nixon the first time. But what I've discovered as I thought about that war, which to me was a turning point, I stopped believing that government was going to tell me the truth. I stopped believing that the basis of decisions would be common understanding in the country and that we would never know why we were doing what we were doing, but there were bound to be alternative and sort of hidden reasons for what the government decided to do in war. And this war, when I think about Calley, I mean, I think about a person who could have had a normal life if he were not over there. I mean, I don't condone what happened at My Lai, but I certainly feel that he was as trapped as a rat in a cage, and there was no out for some people. Some people just weren't psychologically meant to be in the situations they were in. Maybe nobody was meant to be in the situations that they were in Vietnam.
Well, Sharon, thank you very much for your comment. Really appreciate that. Did this change the view of Americans about their government in a significant way, this war, or perhaps an event like My Lai?
I think that the war, the Pentagon Papers, the sense that maybe the government had not been forthright in explaining why we're there and what was happening and what the likely outcome would be, followed quickly by Watergate, I think it obviously led, as Sharon said, to a high level of suspicion and even cynicism about government that wasn't there in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are speaking with Jim Wright. He's the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam. If you served or if you have questions about the war, give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. And let's talk to Ginny in Tilton. Hi, Ginny. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. I'm calling. I was a nurse in Vietnam in 67. I had had the last year of college under scholarship and had those years to return service. I went over in this era of patriotism, and I returned, fortunately, right before the Tet Offensive, when the whole tone of the nation changed and there was an outright anger at our involvement in Vietnam. I witnessed while I was there the damage that was done to the men who were so young, fresh out of high school, who didn't have professions on which they could rest when they came home and use their minds when their bodies had been destroyed so tremendously. So that was a very awful experience. And I find now I've become more aware of how much war equals money, and we go from one war to another, and how much of it is actually needed by the U.S. to be involved. So I think that tone is just very saddening to me. We don't need to be involved in so many others. That's my thoughts. Anyhow, I pray for those who have been involved and are or have loved ones over in foreign countries now.
Well, Ginny, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Two things that you mentioned there. One was sort of the physical toll of the war and how devastating it was. And the second part was, I believe you're referring to the military-industrial complex, which is the theory that there's an incentive to go to war because it's just it's good for American businesses in some way. But let's talk about that first comment with Jim Wright here, the physical toll of this war. Do you think it was more or less or about the same as devastating as other conflicts America has been in?
Well, that's a good question. We were saving more of the kids in the battlefield than we saved in World War II. Disease was not as rampant. We had it more under control. But the nature of some of the casualties was just horrendous, and Ginny observed that. I have in this book accounts from doctors and nurses and medics and corpsmen and also graves registration people who are handling the bodies, and it's really quite stunning. And I think that the nurses, they wanted to go there. They wanted to help out, and they did it. I tell the story of Sharon Lane, who was an Army nurse who was killed 6 weeks after she got there. She was trying to help out in the hospital and all of her spare time. She was in the nearby villages trying to be of assistance to people. And she was killed in a rocket attack at the hospital where she lived. Another nurse told the story of coming home, and her local parish had a potluck supper to welcome her back, and all of her friends and neighbors came, and she realized afterwards that nobody asked me about Vietnam. They were glad to see me home, but they didn't want to ask about it. And I think that was not an uncommon experience, as I said before. People did not ask questions.
And the second part of Ginny's question was related to the military-industrial complex. Was that a factor in your view?
Well, President Eisenhower talked about that, and when he was leaving office, there's no doubt that there are plenty of economic interests that wanted to try to make certain that we defended ourselves and their interests against communism, and they were supportive of the war. I don't know that I would say that they caused the war. I think there are a whole range of factors, including some of the economic ones that were very much a part of it. But the culture of the post-war world, this idea of a global fight with godless communism, was went far beyond economics.
We talked about the draft a little bit already. I wanted to ask you about the socioeconomic status of the people who were fighting the war. Was this a blue-collar war, or was there more or less an even distribution across the economic spectrum?
It was a blue-collar war in terms of those kids who were fighting in the front lines. There's no doubt it was a blue-collar war. It was not uniquely so. There were college graduates, college dropouts who were in the front lines, and not just as officers. So we have to recognize that, particularly after 1968, when the draft no longer provided a deferment for graduate school. There were kids with fresh college degrees that were drafted, and many of them found themselves in the Army. Now, the difference is that they were less likely, that they more likely had a skill that would give them an MOS, an occupational specialty, other than infantrymen. And so I think that those who are less well-educated often found themselves as the infantrymen, and they increasingly were on the front lines.
We are getting a ton of calls, Jim Wright, and that's great. If you're on the line, please hang on. We'd love to get your voice as part of the conversation. If you happen to have dropped out because you were waiting too long, give us a call back. We'd love to have your voice. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love to hear your story about serving in Vietnam, or if you have a question about it. One of the things you write about, Jim Wright, in this book, Enduring Vietnam, is that, you know, around 1968, especially after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., there was significant racial tension inside the United States, and that carried over to the battlefield in Vietnam. Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like, race relations, black and white, in Vietnam?
They were very tense by the last years of the war, just as they had become tense in the United States. There was a sense on the part of a lot of black soldiers, the draftees, even those who enlisted, why are we here fighting a white man's war? At the base camps, there's no doubt there was great tension. There were the redneck and hillbilly factions playing country music with a rebel flag over the tent, and there were the black soldiers playing music and staying by themselves, and there were fights. What I discovered is that out in the field, they left this more or less behind them. As somebody said, some black soldier said, nobody's going to call me a racist term when I'm carrying this weapon under my arm. And out in the field, they realized they had to look out for each other. And as far as I could tell, the accounts that I have, they did. They left these struggles at the base camps, but they were very definitely there, and they became more and more intense. Colin Powell talked about it when he came back to Vietnam on a second tour, I think it was in 1968, just recognizing the greater racial tension over there.
We're speaking with James Wright. He is the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War. We, of course, want you to be part of this discussion. What was it like for you if you served? Do you discuss the war with your fellow veterans? If so, what are those discussions like? Maybe you haven't yet talked about the war because it was just too painful or too disturbing an experience. We want to hear from you. We want to know what it was like for you. Give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to take a short break in just a little bit. We've got some people on the line we'd love to bring into the conversation, and we'd love to hear your voice as well. 1-800-892-6477. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoi, and we're talking with Jim Wright today. He's the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War, and we want you to be a part of this discussion. give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Jim Wright is here in the studio to answer your questions. We're also looking forward to hearing your stories. And right before the break, Jim, you were telling us a little bit about Colin Powell, who did have some firsthand experience in Vietnam. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, he first went to Vietnam in 1963 as an advisor, and I use this story as one that I think underscores some of the circular logic of the war. He was stationed as an American advisor with an Army of the Republic of Vietnam unit up in the Osha Valley, way up in the northwestern part of South Vietnam near Laos. He was at an outpost. He asked a South Vietnamese commander, "Why is this outpost here? What's its purpose?" And the South Vietnamese commander said, "The purpose of this outpost is to defend the airstrip down below." And there was a grass airstrip right down below them. And Powell said, "I understand. What's the purpose of the airstrip?" And he said, "Well, the purpose of the airstrip is to supply the outpost." And Powell said he's not sure he ever heard a better explanation of why, of some of the tactical decisions and the postings in Vietnam.
It's straight out of Catch-22, Joseph Heller.
It sure is.
All right, so we've got some calls here. We want to bring these people into the conversation. Let's talk with Jerry in Guilford. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hey, well, I love the show, and thanks for taking my call. My experience, I was in station in Vietnam up in An K in 1969, and did experience exactly what the author has described. There's so much to talk about, but I will go to my experience coming home. I was embarrassed by the war and the demonstrations, and my closest friend Sonny had been killed over there. He was a medic, and I didn't want his death to be in vain. So I was opposed to the war and trying desperately to fit inside the college campus, you know, and not stand out as we did. You could pick us out of the crowd, the Vietnam veterans, and we were totally excluded. But there was this professor that I had there. His name was Professor Glass, I think his name was, in political science, and he had me read this book. At the time that the school was under siege, the classes were being canceled, and I was totally confused and disheartened. And he said, "Read this book, write a report on it, and that's your course." And I did. The book was called "Home from the War: Vietnam Veterans, Neither Victims Nor Executioners," and it was written by Robert J. Lifton, a professor at Yale at the time, who was renowned for his research on survivor guilt syndrome. And so he had me read the book, and I think it changed my life. It turned me around and enabled me to then protest the war, because it was total absurdity, the whole thing. It was what an experience. Well, anyway.
So you're saying that you were able to protest as a result of, you know, going back to college and sort of giving good time to think about what happened? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. Lifton tried to make sense out of, for example, My Lai. He went into great detail about My Lai, the build up to it, and the Americal soldiers who were sent over there. They were the first, I believe, to really have guerrilla training and how to fight a guerrilla war, and went over there, and they were sitting ducks, and they were specially trained, but still their casualty rate was extremely high when they first got there, and they were frustrated. Anyway, Lifton wasn't trying to justify My Lai. He just explained how it happened. and it worked for me in that it gave me a different perspective, and it eased my guilt. We were embarrassed to be known and thought as baby killers, but that was rampant then. I think the military industrial complex was so large and so impregnable that demonstrations on campus is what became the rule, and soldiers then became the targets because they're easier, more accessible. They're coming in from airports and such,
Jerry, let's give it to Jim Wright and have him comment a little bit on the protests, especially on college campuses. Jim Wright, what impact do you think those protests had on the war in general?
Oh, I think that the Lyndon Johnson was pretty dismissive of them, as was Richard Nixon. But I think that they really did have an impact on them and on the war. It was hard to downplay that. I think Jerry's experience as a veteran was not uncommon. Many of the veterans, most of the veterans that I spoke to, perhaps nearly all of them, by the time they came home, were pretty disillusioned with the nature of the war. But very few of them engaged in protest because they didn't like the protesters. And part of that was that they thought the protesters had really been rooting for the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And they didn't like that. They may, as Jerry did, have lost a friend over there. And they just didn't want to be part of that. But some of them joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and others more quietly went about their life. But they had difficulty. And Robert Lifton, whom Jerry mentioned, I think was very much a patron and somebody involved with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War group.
Let's talk to Pat in Brookline. Pat, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Rice, thank you for not forgetting the Vietnam vets. That's my first point. I had never served in the military, but I had three brothers, two in the Army, one in the Marines, who served in Vietnam later in the war. And there's a couple of things about that. Number one, I don't know if it ever actually was called a war or we declared war. None of them really ever understood what their purpose there was, so that's one thing. The other thing, none of them came home okay. They all came home with severe alcohol and drug problems. There was no support for them, literally. When they came home, they were called, baby killers. People would spit on them. It was horrific. And I feel finally, through people like yourself, we're getting to pay them homage that these are heroes. Unfortunately, all three of them have passed due to their disease of alcoholism. But if you could address that, and just God bless you for doing that, and any vets listening to this, thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Pat. James Wright.
Well, Pat, thank you, and belated thanks to your brothers. I think you said they served in the later parts of the war, and that was particularly difficult because by then, clearly, the United States was drawing down. We no longer were seeking a military victory, and I wonder how you can sustain the morale you need to have in the field if there's a sense that there's no longer a military goal. Then indeed your goal is to try to reduce the number of American casualties. The tactics of the war changed in the last couple of years. And many of the people coming home did not get the counseling they needed. Some of them had difficulty reaching out for it. I think we just have to understand that, but they didn't get it. One person said he went to the VA in 1972 and talked about nightmares and problems he was having, and a doctor said, get out of here with that crap. I don't want to talk about that. Get over it. And he said he never went back for 30 years, and by then the VA was far more hospitable to these stories because in 1979 there was a recognition that post-traumatic stress was indeed a clinical condition, and the government began to respond to it.
Mm-hmm. And certainly now things at the VA have changed. They have special events for Vietnam veterans.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Carrie in Durham. Carrie, what's your question or comment?
Hi, Mr. Wright. This is Carrie. I noticed a couple times that you said that when people came back from Vietnam, nobody spoke to them, nobody asked them questions. My question to you is, what do you say? What kinds of questions do you say to these young men and these women who come back from these places? How do you approach them? What do you say? Can you give me some?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Carrie, because in truth, many of them are not interested in talking about it, but I think what they were looking for then was some recognition that they had been there, some acknowledgement, some basic question about how are you, how was it, how did you do, may we be of assistance to you. But it was like they had been on a trip someplace and nobody talked about it. One Marine said that his dad had been at Iwo Jima, and he came back and he thought, well, my father and I can have some talks about this. And he said, my father never did ask me how it was in Vietnam, and people just didn't quite know what to say about it. And I think what you have to do is acknowledge and recognize that they were there, and what they will say, it has to be controlled by them. Some of them want to talk about it. In the 1970s, not surprisingly, most didn't. But I think in 1946, most World War II veterans would not want to talk about it. The difference was that they got together in groups at the VFW and the American Legion. In the 1970s, the Legion and the VFW were not all that hospitable to Vietnam veterans. They were more or less clubs for World War II veterans. They thought that the Vietnam veterans were hippies and whiners, and so they didn't have that same sort of club environment. Ironically, today, the Vietnam veterans, of course, control the VFW, and they do an exceptional job with it. But they had some difficulty in the early years.
Regarding the end of the war, there are some veterans who argue that the war was not lost, but they would say, and you quote one in your book saying, we were withdrawn. There were some that still wanted to stick in and fight to the very end until it was another American victory. Is that a common sentiment among veterans, according to your interviews?
Yeah, I don't know, but when Saigon fell in 1975, I think a lot of veterans few of them were surprised. I think some of them felt sad by it, not so much because the South Vietnamese government had fallen, but they thought, what did we do this for? What did our friends die for? What did we suffer and sacrifice for? And I think it was more that reaction. There were very few that were eager to go back over and to continue the fight in 1975 among the veterans or the American public. I think they just had enough of it.
James Wright, I remember, and I think we had one caller who didn't quite make it on the air, a question about this. Some discussion about Vietnam in 2003 when President George W. Bush invaded Iraq. Some folks said it would be another quagmire like Vietnam, shifting objectives, no clear battle lines, an enemy that can easily blend into the general population. In your view, was that a fair comparison?
I think that there are some real comparisons there of going into war with some fairly limited military objectives. And I think we have to recognize that when we send the military in, there should be a military objective. And toppling Saddam Hussein's government was a military objective. I have argued, I wrote a piece a few years ago on an op-ed, when Bush landed on the carrier Abraham Lincoln in May of 2003 with the big banner behind him, he didn't place it there. The sailors did, mission accomplished. And people teased and talked and were cynical about that for many years afterwards because we kept fighting in Iraq. Ironically, the military objective was accomplished by May of 2003. Nobody knew what to do next. And I think it's what to do next that people have to think through. The American military today is a very powerful force. They can go in and they can execute a military operation pretty quickly and almost certainly successfully. What do you do next? And you can't just leave them hanging around to look after things, because then they get drawn into the sort of war that with rules of engagement that they're not prepared to fight.
Because as you write, yes, the American military is powerful, very powerful, but power isn't necessarily the deciding factor in who wins a war.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there was a story of an American officer meeting a North Vietnamese officer after the war, and the American officer said, we beat you in every battle we fought. And the North Vietnamese officer said, so what? We won the war. It's more complicated than that, but I think it does reveal something.
So what parallels, if any, do you see between the political leadership we had during the Vietnam War and the leadership we have now?
Boy, that's an interesting and an altogether different session of the exchange, isn't it, Peter?
But maybe yes, maybe no.
I think that the leadership in the Vietnam War, the political leadership, Johnson and Nixon and Kennedy, these were the World War II generation. They had a view of the world. They had a view of America's role in the world. They had a sense of American responsibility. They had a sense of American military capacity. They were never directly honest. They were never fully candid about what we're getting into in Vietnam. I'm not sure that the leadership today thinks about things in these larger strategic ways. And I don't want to get into this with President Trump. I have great confidence in General Mattis. He's a good man and he's a good Marine. But I think we have to look at the consequences. A bombing raid may be successful, but that doesn't mean it's the end of the story.
So have we learned our lessons from Vietnam?
Well, I think there are a lot of lessons from Vietnam. People talk about the lessons from Vietnam, and there are a whole list of them. And people from the right and the left and the anti-war and the pro-war have their own lessons they derive from it. I don't think we've learned our lessons of recognizing that if you send in military force, ask kids to go in and put their lives at stake, you have to have some sort of military mission. You have to have an end game. You have to know what it is that they're supposed to accomplish. It can't be open-ended, and it can't be used as a piece on a chessboard to facilitate some sort of political negotiation.
Well, James Wright, thank you very much for joining us on The Exchange and talking about your book.
Thank you, Peter. I'm delighted to be here.
That's James Wright. He's the author of the new book, Enduring Vietnam, An American Generation and Its War. He's also president emeritus at Dartmouth College. And Wright will be at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on May 4th and at Morgan Hill Bookstore in New London on May 18th. And listeners, you can find out more information about his appearances on our webpage, nhpr.org/exchange. Remember, the conversation continues online. Lots of calls we couldn't take this hour, but we still want to hear from you. Join us on Facebook at NHP and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.